Greetings. Before you listen to today's monstrosity
podcast,
yes, I have two warnings for you. Warning number one, this episode is exceptionally lame.
Hey, Sean.
Yes?
Sorry, I can't argue with that. Continue.
And second, this episode is replete with spoilers. For Rish's stories, Like a Good Neighbor, and You're in Good Hands. The endings of the stories shall be spoiled, as will any good mood you might have brought with you to the podcast in the first place.
What? No problems with that? No, that's accurate, actually.
Rish would like nothing more than for you to have bought or listened to both of those stories beforehand. So, there are your warnings. Also, try not to eat any yellow snow.
Thank you.
Hey there, folks. This is Rish Outfield, and you are listening to the Rish Outcast. And this episode will not be done from the car. I had intended to start it from the car, but why not just give you an episode with good sound for once? So the whole episode will be like this. This is an interesting episode because it's all going to be about the Laura and the Witch series. And depending on your perspective, there are four stories in the Laura and the Witch series, starting with Like a Good Neighbor. Or there are some peripheral stories, like Remember the Future, in which case I believe there are seven stories, if you're going to do it that way. But of the main Laura and the Witch series, there's only four. And I'm going to go ahead and release the newest one that I wrote sometime soon in 2021, and then when I get around to it, I will release the much longer story called Bundling Made Easy that I wrote in the fall of 2020. The Christmas story I wrote in December of 2020. Anyway, this was all inspired by an email that I got that is 10 questions about the Laura and the Witch series. And I'm going to answer those now.
Oh, ho, witchy woman, she's got the moon in her eyes.
All right, 10 questions from, oh, looks like he's in law enforcement. This is a Air Marshal Latham.
Marshal of the New Republic.
Oh, no, it's H-E-R-R. So Mr. Marshal, oh, Marshal's his first name. Lame. Okay, here's his questions.
Hey, Rish. You know, as I was reading or listening to your Laura and the Witch collection, I had some questions that I wanted to ask you. And I thought, well, why don't I just sit down and write 10 questions about this series? And maybe you can use this for a Rish Outcast or something like that. Or you can just answer the questions and I'll be happy with that.
Number one, does the name of the pendant...
Does the name of the pendant something something blah blah dispendula or something like that, did the name for that or did the thought of that come from anything in particular?
Yes, I mean it's not anything that will impress you, quite the contrary. So dije is Spanish for pendant or charm, necklace kind of thing. Dije de espíndola is essentially just Espíndola's pendant. Big Anklevich was super into soccer for a while there. I mean, maybe he still is, but, you know. He used to go to games, and I went to a game with him, and one of the players' last names was Espíndola. And the guys over the announcers always... There were dueling announcers. There were dueling announcers. because most of the people there in the audience spoke Spanish, because that just, you know, that's how soccer works. And also, culturally, the announcers are just way more into the game in Spanish than they are in English. And it amused me every single time I heard these announcers say, Espíndola! And so I started saying, Espíndola! Every time the guy got the ball, which sounds like a basketball thing. You know what I mean, though. So I vowed to Big that I would write, I would insert that into a story, that I would have a character called Espíndola. And there was another player, and his name was Forco. You know, it wasn't even a Spanish thing. It was just F-O-R-K-O, Forco. I should look it up. I should look these guys up right now, since I haven't got anything better to do. And the saddest thing is, neither do you. You're listening to this. Come on, guys. Isn't there, like, porn to watch? Ooh, did you hear that? Puberty finally found me. So the guy's name was Fabian Espíndola. He's from Argentina, and I just thought that that was the coolest name, and that's how that entered into it. It's not very interesting, but it amused Big, and there was another player on the team called Forco, F-O-R-K-O, Willis Forco. First name, you know, makes him less exotic. But Forco was just such a funny name. I wish that had caught on, you know, when we were upset, we'd say Forco. Didn't happen, though. Number two. The Bone Man was pretty creepy.
And hopefully you're going to advise people that these are spoiler-filled questions. So if they haven't listened to these, then I'm going to spoil a lot in these questions. Number two. The Bone Man was pretty creepy. Is he really dead? You have hinted at another big bad arriving in the future.
The Bone Man was killed at the end of You're in Good Hands. And I don't really have anything interesting to say. I mean, the Bone Man is a ridiculous name, almost as ridiculous as Espíndola, but I'm not sure that I ever had Lara make fun of it, because he was a scary guy and Holcomb wouldn't talk about him. Bones are scary. Bones remind us of mortality. Bones remind us of rot. And I just liked the idea that as old and corrupt as Holcomb is, there are others out there that are older. Although I think it's revealed that he's just a tiny bit older than she is. But, you know, he'd still hold that over her. Something that's been really interesting in writing these stories is coming from the angle that Lara is inherently good and Holcomb is inherently bad. I keep finding humanity in Holcomb. I keep finding softness in her, and I think that's fine. I like the idea that in the time that they're together, you would think that Lara gets corrupted by Holcomb's influence, but it's quite the opposite, and Holcomb becomes happier, and she becomes a better person because of the influence of this girl, and because of, ultimately, having to become her guardian and become her mother. There's this moment in the third book, which is called Bundling Made Easy, where Lara calls Holcomb mom, and then she corrects herself, and she's kind of mortified by it, because by this point, I think Lara is 16 or 17, and Holcomb brushes it off, and they continue, but that makes an impact on her. And I remember there was a time when my nephew and I were spending a good deal together and we would go to stores together and all that. He's moved on from that. He doesn't want to spend time with me anymore. And he called me dad, just by accident. And then he wasn't mortified by it the way that Lara would be. And I was just like, wow, that's really interesting. And that moment in Bundling came from that. There is another villain coming, and he was supposed to show up in Bundling Made Easy. Bundling Made Easy is the story of Lara falling in love in high school, but finding it very difficult to trust that it's real, because she lives in a world where magic affects people. And ultimately, I found that part of the story way more interesting than Holcomb's story, which was discovering that her son is still out there, and her son doesn't know her, And her son blames her, of course, for the death of his father. And so I only hinted at that in Bundling Made Easy. Bundling Made Easy originally was going to be called On Your Side. And it was Lara has this boyfriend thing and Holcomb has this son thing. But I stepped away from that and I just sort of hinted at it in the story that I finished. And in the next story, that's when the son will show up. And maybe that one can be called On Your Side. Although there are a bunch of really cool potential titles out there that make me want to write a bunch of these. I've said bunch too many times. It's starting to sound like one of those words. Like I don't think that's really a word. Like bundling. Three.
Number three. I was shocked by the death of Laura's whole family. I knew something bad was going to happen to her sister because you kind of foreshadowed that. You talk about how you knew they would die going into writing this because of your story, Remember the Future. So if Good Hands was the first story you had written after Good Neighbor, would you have ever written something so drastic?
No, obviously. I mean, you seem to have hit the nail on the head there. I didn't want to kill Lara's family. I didn't want to hurt the girl. I like the girl. Remember the Future was a story that I wrote around 2017. No, it would have been before then. There was a girl at work, and her name was Tally, and I had never heard that name before. And I would say, come, Mr. Tally, man, Tally. And she'd be like, eh, because I guess everybody does that. And I said, but do they do it in the Caribbean accent? And she was not impressed with me. And I told my coworker, Austin, that I really liked this Tally girl. And the day that she quits, I'm going to quit. And he was just like, what? Why? You really like her that much? And I said, no. But there was this girl, Sierra, that worked with us. And Sierra was beautiful. But she was not only married, but pregnant. And she ultimately quit once her pregnancy started to show. And she wanted to be a mom or work with Legos or something like that. And there was a guy that had told Austin, a coworker that had told Austin, the second Sierra quits, I'm quitting too. And he asked this guy, he's just like, what? But why? She's married. And he says, yes, but I love her. And true love lasts a lifetime. And he did. He quit when Sierra quit. And I get that. Sierra was beautiful, dude, but... Anyway, I told Austin that I was going to quit as soon as Tally quit, and then I got fired. So I never saw Tally again. But I thought I would write a story about her. And so I wrote this story, Remember the Future, and it was about a girl that was rude to a co-worker. Not co-worker. To a student. It was about a high school student that's rude to another high school student and then gets a curse put on her by like an old Chinese, you know, like an old Chinese woman. Where everybody's afraid of old Chinese women. Come on, let's not mince words here. And as I started writing it, I thought, you know, why does it have to be an old Chinese woman? Why can't it be an old Vietnamese woman? No, why can't it be old Widow Holcomb from the Lara and the Witch story? And so I did. I switched it to that. And then I switched that the girl she was rude to in school was Lara Deming. And Holcomb comes up to her and says, you know, I didn't like what you said to that girl. And the girl, and Tally doesn't care because she only cares about herself. And the witch says, you may not know this, but Lara has had a very hard life. She lost her whole family in a car accident. And she could use a friend. She could use support. She could use a little bit of empathy from the people around her. And so Holcomb curses Tally that anybody she looks in the eyes, she will see how they will die. And Tally indeed learns empathy in this story. It's a really solid story, and you've probably heard it. I did an episode sitting around a campfire about it. And... at that point, I had never intended to follow up Like a Good Neighbor. Because if you recall, Like a Good Neighbor ends with Holcomb getting another dije de espíndola, getting another espíndola pendant to replace the one that Lara has stolen. And so the spell is broken and Lara is no longer protected. And that was the end of the story. The tables are turned, and it was inspired by the ending of my favorite Tom and Jerry episode that I saw when I was a little boy, about 7 or 8, and it made such an impact on me because at the end of the episode, Tom the cat kills Jerry and the duck. He wins. And I went nuts. I ran around screaming and jumping and laughing. I killed 2 of my neighbors in a copycat kind of thing. And nobody believed me. For years and years, people didn't believe me that there would ever be an episode of Tom and Jerry where the cat won. And because I always liked the cat more, which is ironic because I'm not a cat person. I saw the cat as the good guy and the mouse as the villain. And I was just the exact same way on the Roadrunner cartoons, but I don't remember there ever being one where the coyote gets to eat the Roadrunner. And that was the end of Like a Good Neighbor, is Laura Deming doesn't get to go home. She does not have a happy ending. But it was left vague enough that you could have some wiggle room. And so when I put this witch in Remember the Future, the floodgates opened and suddenly I wanted to write new stories about these 2 characters. And so I followed it up with others. And here we are. You know, I am 2 or 3 days after writing another story, one called Made Just for You. And so there we go. But yes, okay, sorry, let me go back to your question. I had had this reference in Remember the Future that Laura's family had died in a car accident. And so as I was writing You're in Good Hands, I knew that that's how it was going to end. And I didn't want to do that, but I did. And it affects everything after that. I have my 3rd book, which is Bundling Made Easy, but there's a good space of time. Bundling Made Easy starts when Laura is 15. And so there are many adventures they could have in between those. And that reminds me of Robert E. Howard. He wrote all these Conan stories. Then he wrote other stories about like Kull the Conqueror, or he wrote those before. And ultimately those got changed to become Conan stories. The very first Conan story, Frost Giant's daughter, Conan, is a certain age. And I think the second Conan story, the second one that he wrote, Conan is already the king. And there's been a long stretch of years there. And so people have taken the stories and tried to make sort of a chronology of them. And it's not really possible because of the nature of these stories and the way that they were written. And some of them didn't get published in Howard's lifetime. Howard died so young. Had he lived to be, you know, middle-aged or old, I would think that he would have revised all of these stories and put them in an order, and it would have been a definitive thing, the way that Tolkien... Well, Tolkien died before he could finish his revisions and all that, too, so I don't know what I'm talking about. But I'm just saying that in between the second book and the third book are a number of years in which many stories could take place, and Made Just for You takes place in between those 2. And so, yeah, I would not have written anything so drastic. I didn't want to hurt Laura, kills Laura's family. And they hadn't really been developed. Laura had this older sister who was beautiful. And that was something that really spoke to me. I don't know how much I've described what Laura looks like, but I had described that her sister was, you know, like a Barbie doll. And I wanted to explore that. What would that be like to have a sister that is the pretty one? And everything that I wrote in 2020 was affected by the feelings that I had about mortality, about the coronavirus, about a midlife crisis, about trying to get in shape, writing every single day, about changing my stars, and a young woman that had inspired me. And so a lot of that, I wish that I could have developed Laura and her sister more, and Laura's jealousy of her sister's good looks, because that jealousy becomes guilt once the sister is dead. And so that's stuff that I can touch on in the future. She was jealous of her, but they were so young that they never had like a boy that Laura liked. And then the boy
was interested in her sister. I mean, how heartbreaking that would that be? It seems really terrible. But I can explore that in other stories with other relationships. It just, you know, that's, if I had intended to write this as a series from the beginning, that's something that you establish. Like, I think her stepdad's name is Charlie. And in the first draft of the story, I don't think he ever even speaks. The revised draft, he goes downstairs because he hears her walking around and they do have this interaction. But knowing that they were going to die, maybe it's better not to develop. No, that's lazy.
Number four. Will Tally from Remember the Future make an appearance in Lara and the Witch 3 or 4?
No, she has not shown up in either of those stories. I'll probably put her in somewhere. It would be nice, actually, if Tally befriended Lara. If eventually they became, like, by the time of her high school graduation, they were best friends. I think that would be very neat. But no, so far she hasn't even been mentioned.
Number five. In Lara and the Witch 3 and 4, are you similarly planning to chronicle around the events teased in your side stories? Mainly the big dust-up between Lara and Holcomb.
Okay, so I wrote two stories, Exchange at a Harvest Festival and Fruish Memorial. One was about Holcomb and one was about Lara. And they're sort of non-canon because I wrote them to be about something else. Both of these stories have been on The Outcast. I haven't put them in any collections. And ultimately, if there was a Lara and the Witch collection that included all the stories, I don't know that I would include these. But what has happened in these two stories is that Lara and Holcomb have had a big fight. Dust up. I love that he used dust up. And that Lara has lost her temper and she cast a spell on Holcomb, presumably to kill her, and it didn't work. And then Lara runs away. She goes to the movie theater where she has had all this, these happy memories, and it has burned down. And she's sad about that. And I just wrote that story when they closed the local movie theater, which I had had so many happy memories about. And I went on the very last day and I watched Moana and cried, but I would have cried anyway because Moana is great. And then I wrote this story as a tribute to that movie theater. And then not long after that, I wrote a story called Exchange at a Harvest Festival, where a guy is taking pictures at, you know, the town, you know, Halloween festival or whatever. And he meets this child fortune teller, and it's old widow Holcomb, but she has been reverted to the age of a child. And I mostly just wanted a chance to have a really creepy, mean child fortune teller. And yeah, basically what happened is after those two had their big fight, Lara cast this spell, and instead of it killing Holcomb, it turned her back into a child. And Holcomb has an easy way to get back to adulthood, and that is by taking the life essence, essentially, from people. And so in Exchange at a Harvest Festival, she takes a couple years off of this guy, the photographer. You know, she doesn't drain his life all the way, which she normally would have done, but I think the influence of this girl in her life has made it so she just doesn't do that. She takes a couple of his years and then gets a little bit older, and she's back on her way to being where she wants to be. Holcomb is extraordinarily old, and I thought I had established in one of these recent stories, in one of the 2020 stories, exactly what her age was. But maybe it's better if it's kind of vague. I've been rewatching 30 Rock. It's the one show that I chose to watch because almost every single episode I laugh out loud, and sometimes multiple times in an episode. There are a couple of stinkers. And the thing that was fun about 30 Rock, the first time that I watched it, it took years to watch it. Well, because it was still on the air. Sorry. It took me years to get through it, though, because I hated half of the characters. Hated. And I remember I used to watch the opening credits, and I would give thumbs up and thumbs down on the characters that I liked and I disliked. And the majority of those characters are thumbs way down. It has the least likable cast of any show that I like. And Tina Fey in her book said that NBC executives didn't like the show because the characters weren't attractive. And I think that that's part of it, except for that they're just all so unlikable. Anyhow, one thing that I have noticed as I've been watching the show is that there is a through line that Kenneth the Page is not only way older than he looks, but way, way, way older than is humanly possible. There was this line where he referenced that when he first came to work for NBC, an 8-year-old Shirley Temple taught him how to roll cigarettes. And then I think there was a reference to something that happened like in the 1800s that he witnessed. And that has been really fun. It's something that I didn't really pick up on when I first watched it because it took years. Watching it all, you know, in, not in one sitting, but, you know, in a 3-month stretch like I'm doing, I pick up on these little things that Kenneth is immortal, it seems like. And yeah, so that's the thing with Holcomb. Although I think I spell out how old Holcomb is and that she has a glamour to appear however old she wishes to be. And this dust up, as Marshall put it, between the two characters was going to be Holcomb seducing this boy that Laura liked because she's evil. And she saw that Laura liked him and she's like, well, then I'll do him. And ultimately that didn't happen in Bundling Made Easy. That's the story where Laura falls in love. And it could still happen because I think Laura is a junior in high school and she still has her whole senior year ahead of her. She still has her whole life ahead of her. I don't know why we as a society are so focused on high school. Me as a randy middle-aged man is so focused on high school girls. But that's what I tend to write about. And I don't think it's just me. It's just there is something fascinating about that, about your childhood is behind and you're starting to learn who you are and have feelings that you never had before. And girls start to discover this power that they have, but they don't know that they have it and they don't know how to control it. And why did this work and why did it not work the next time? And that goes hand in hand with learning magic and spells and having a power that you didn't know that you possessed. I mean, you can call me a horn dog if you want, but to me, it's just interesting, those two parallels. Was there? Oh, this was, in Laura and the Witch 3 and 4, are you planning the big dust up? So I wanted that. I wanted the dust up. I wanted it to be over a guy. And that's what I was building toward in Bundling Made Easy, and ultimately that didn't happen. I decided to give Laura a happy ending, and it's because I like her and I feel for her and I don't want her to suffer. And I understand that you have to make your characters suffer for us to care. We'll see if, when I release that, if people think that it worked or didn't work. I don't know.
I don't know!
But there's still the dust up coming, and in which case I can re-canonize Exchange and Fruish Memorial. So that goes right there. But question number six, do Laura and Old Widow Holcomb
live in Praesden? I don't think it is stated specifically in the main stories, but if so,
was that a retcon or was it always set there in your mind? That is a brilliant question because no, that was not supposed to be Praesden. Praesden is this city, this town, that I first started writing about in the year 2000 in a story called Space Shit, The Next Generation, because I had started writing a story called Space Shit when I was a kid. And I wanted it to take place at our high school, the high school that we had gone to. And so I just decided that Praesden High School is the name of this, and the town is Praesden. And I started writing a bunch of stories about that because I had moved away from home. I was homesick. I missed my friends. And so, I just started writing these stories about this town. And there was a hill that all of us went ice blocking on or sledding on in that town. I didn't live in the town, but that's where I went to high school. And I decided that that would be Chenugana Hill. And then the city park became Chenugana Park. And I started coming up with different places. There's a convenience store. There was a 7-Eleven when I was in high school. But it's no longer a 7-Eleven. It's just, you know, a mom and pop
convenience store, and that became the Shop and Go. And I had mentioned the Fruish Theater there in Praisedon. And so when Laura goes to the burned out shell of the Fruish Theater, which burned down in a story called Popcorn Movies, she remembers the movies that she saw there and the good times that she had. And after I put that out there, I realized, whoops, Laura and Holcomb didn't live in Praisedon. And so I decided, well, okay, I'm never going to share that story with anybody else. It's not going to be in my collections. It's non-canon. Except that after You're in Good Hands ends with the death of Laura's family, Laura and Holcomb have to move from the town that they're in. And so why not have them move to Praisedon? And so all the rest of the stories take place in Praisedon. The one that I just finished, Made Just for You, is the first Christmas that they have in this new town together. So, ultimately, Fruish Memorial could be recanonized because Laura is spending the next few years in this town. And so, of course, she could acquire happy memories of this movie theater there. In fact, I have her go to Shenugana Park in my story. So there you go. That was a retcon, but now it no longer is. Now they just go to Praisedon. And see, that's something that made me think. So Holcomb has enemies, and she has killed someone who is extremely powerful, who probably has extremely powerful friends. So why does she allow Laura to keep her name, Laura Deming? And I justified that because only the Bone Man knew who this girl was. The name doesn't mean anything. But Holcomb still puts a spell on Laura that if somebody recognizes her from her old life, because she still has like cousins out there, she still has like an aunt out there that she could have stayed with. But I had Holcomb foresee that if somebody from her past recognized her or saw her, that they would forget. So that's another reason that poor Laura is going to be lonely, is that even if she reconnected with somebody from her past, they would forget. And at one point, I wanted to do it in Bundling Made Easy, but I didn't. I wanted her to call the kid that she had put a spell on in the very first story, the love spell on, just to see. And I can't remember what his name was. I wanted her to call this boy and ask him if he remembered that. And for her to realize, for him to confess that he never stopped loving this girl that he had feelings for in sixth grade or seventh grade. And that just crushes Laura, the thought of that. He says, I never loved anybody the way that I loved her. I wanted that to open Laura's eyes. And I think I'll still have that happen at some point in one of these stories. Because I want her to feel like with great power, there must also come ... And it was supposed to fit into Bundling Made Easy, but it doesn't look like it's in there. I just think that if you had this power, this potentially immense power that Laura is fiddling with, that you would misuse it, that you would forget how big a deal it is, that you would mess with people. And I'm going to write stories like that. But the difference between Laura and Holcomb is Holcomb doesn't care who she hurts. And Laura does. In the Christmas story, she casts a spell on this girl. And it is a positive spell. It is a spell to help her. And I feel like if you had these abilities, any time that life threw you a curveball, you would want to fix things with magic. That's something that happened on Buffy the Vampire Slayer at the end of the series, is Willow. She started using magic to solve all of her problems, and ultimately it corrupted her. And that's not ever going to happen with Laura, although it could. I shouldn't close that door 100%. Like, what if Laura is feeling super alone and sad on the anniversary of her family's death, and she wishes them back? That is a story right there. What if she wishes that she had a big sister, and there's a girl at school that reminds her of her sister, that is pretty and blonde and popular, and she's like, I wish she was my sister.
that's a story right there of what, how do you deal with this power where you can have whatever you want, but part of life, part of being a human being is not getting all the things that you want. I guess in my case, any of the things that I want, but I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you and I wouldn't be writing these stories if I got what I want. A friend of mine, the producer friend that got me the gig last year, texted me and he said, would you be interested in writing a script for the Sci-Fi Channel? And unlike the first time last year when he made me an offer like this, I hesitated not at all. I texted him back and said, yeah, absolutely, let's talk about it. And after I had done that, I thought about it and I thought, oh, shoot, you know, this is going to be work. And the stuff that they run on the Sci-Fi Channel is not what I like to write. And I don't know if I'll be able to write something that satisfies them. And oh, how painful will that be? Shoot, I would rather just write stuff for me, the write the things that I want to write. And that is just asinine. If I could write something for somebody else with a paycheck involved, that is the dream. Is to be paid for my writing, to be a professional screenwriter. I didn't want to write short stories. I wanted to write for the movies. Even if I wrote some piece of shit, sci-fi movie, I'd be there. That's much farther along than I ever got. And the thing is, even if I wrote something and they really liked it and they paid me for it, that doesn't mean that it would get produced. The vast percentage of screenplays that are optioned don't get produced. And that's a fine career. Yeah, everybody wants their name in lights. Everybody wants to go to a movie and see their name there. But being able to feed yourself with your imagination, that's a more worthy goal. And so, yeah, sorry about that. I that was a tangent that I didn't mean to throw at you. I just want to be able to write these things that inspire me, that excite me. And the trick is you have to do both. You have to write stuff that people like and be happy with the stuff that people like. You have to write what people want, but write it good enough that you feel good too. Anyway, sorry, Marshall. Number 7.
How far is Laura Deming going to go toward the dark side?
See, there you go. I was just answering that question before I even saw it. I'm going to have things go not her way. Like I said earlier, we want our characters to suffer so that people care what happens to them. But she is inherently good. So no matter how far she goes to the dark side, she's not irredeemable. Every single good character is corrupted story of the last 40 years, I feel, has been either a ripoff or influenced by Marvel Comics' Dark Phoenix saga in the X-Men. That's the best it's ever been done, and it's not perfect. There are still a couple of, you know, bits that don't work in that, but Chris Claremont wrote that with John Byrne. We'll give Byrne the credit. I mean, Byrne's art is the best it ever was. It's so beautiful. Oh my gosh. But it's the most famous X-Men arc, and essentially Jean Grey dies and comes back with this unbelievable power. It's, you know, she becomes the Phoenix. She rises from the ashes. And with this new power, she changes. And ultimately she gets her mind messed with and she turns to the dark side and she becomes Dark Phoenix, and her power grows exponentially with this Dark Phoenix persona. She becomes a god, but a dark god. Marshall and I should sit down and just do a whole conversation about the Dark Phoenix saga. I'm sure it's been done before and done better by a lot of other people, but it's still so good. And the fact that Fox has tried to do it twice and not done it right either time may mean that it's unadaptable. But essentially at the end of the Dark Phoenix saga, Jean unleashes this power. She loses control and she ends up killing billions of people.
she wipes out this planet of aliens, and John Byrne drew them as sort of asparagus people. And I think that that was done purposely because they're not human. They're aliens. You know, they're not really people. But Jim Shooter, who was the editor-in-chief at that time, said, no, you know, she just killed billions of people. There have to be consequences. And the consequences that Claremont and Byrne had come up with was that she is stripped of all of her powers and just becomes a regular human being. And she and Cyclops leave the X-Men, and she has to spend the rest of her life as just a person, but they get a happily ever after. And Jim Shooter wouldn't accept that. He said, no, you have to kill her. And so they did, and spent the next 40 years retconning that. Some of the retcons are really, really good, actually, but they couldn't leave her dead. And so when Joss Whedon did it on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it really felt like he had appreciated this arc, and he was going to do it with the least likely character, who was Willow. And it's so well done, but it partly is because he had episode after episode to do it, to set it up, to have her stick her foot in the pool instead of just jump in. But Willow was never, Dark Willow was never 100% evil. She was hurt, and she was heartbroken, and she was angry. We understood she was addicted to magic. And I guess what I'm saying is that eventually Lara will probably go and dip her foot in the pool. And it may be that this villain that I'm setting up will be somebody that Holcomb can't defeat. And Lara has to do it. But to defeat him, she has to become like him. I don't know. I have no plans of writing this right now. We will see. So I guess that answers your question, that she's going to dip her foot in the pool and we will find out what happens.
Number 8. How many more witches are there in the world?
Oh, gosh. Good question.
Does Lara get more entangled in their continuity?
In their community, if one exists. Okay, so there is a community of witches. And in Bundling Made Easy, Holcomb has been making money by selling charms, by going and doing castings for people. She goes to, is it Grand Junction, Colorado, or Colorado Springs? They're one of those two towns. I visited Grand Junction a few years ago, and I loved the town. I thought, oh my gosh, this is where I want to live. And I told my friend Jeff that, and then I've never been back. And so I put Grand Junction in stories from time to time. That's where Holcomb is going to meet with other witches. And I think eventually we'll have a story where Lara goes along and we get to find out exactly how many witches there are and what the witches are like. And wouldn't it be fun if some of them are teens? It would be such a contrast, because I want some of these girls to be so reptilian that they make Holcomb seem just like Angela Lansbury in Bedknobs and Broomsticks. And so, yes, your question is, oh, how many more witches? I don't know. They're not a lot. Like, Holcomb and Lara are in Praesden, and if there is a single other witch in that whole town, I would be surprised. I think not. I think the town that Lara and her family lived in, Holcomb was the only witch. I feel like there are not a lot left, that the old ways have died out. And then also just the nature of these witches is self-destructive. They have so much power that they can't help but use it, draw attention to themselves, use it on each other, make enemies, and be exterminated. Hopefully that is an interesting answer to that question.
Number 9. Would you consider a prequel story titled We Are Farmers of Holcomb?
Of Holcomb in the 1800s, where she ends up on a farm in New Mexico or something for some reason.
Maybe it could be a Green Acres type of thing.
Maybe Ben Parks could have a run-in with her. That's very, very funny on more than one level. The majority of the Ben Parks stories take place in 1896. It's 1896 when Jerome Cook takes Ben Parks from the orphanage. That's the end of the Old West.
Essentially, once the automobile is invented, the Old West is over. But it had been dying a fairly quick death with the railroad and with the telegraph, with just modern life. Once the railroad came through and people weren't so isolated, you know, the Old West was a place on the frontier where there was frontier justice, where there was nobody to help you, where there was savages, where there was crime, where there was a harsh, unrelenting winter, a harsh, unrelenting sun. And so the Ben Parks stories take place after almost all that is over and civilization has taken over. Holcomb should not have been born by the time Ben Parks is walking around, but I could easily have her as a baby or as a child in one of these stories. I wouldn't dare call it We Are Farmers. Although, gosh, I see what you're saying, is that they are, it's a conclave of witches that are pretending to be farmers. Okay, I'm not going to rule that out 100%.
Number 10, will Laura ever visit a bed and breakfast in Vernon, Idaho? Who would visit her if she did?
I was going to say no, because that's two questions. I never have any plans of Laura Deming ever going to the Noble Oaks bed and breakfast. But who would visit her if she did? She's lost her whole family. If Laura found out that there was a place in Idaho where when you go there, you can commune with someone who is dead, of course she would go there. The thing is, there are probably spells and ways for her to communicate with her loved ones. And the idea of her bringing back somebody, that's very interesting. I can see her wanting to go there, her being 15 and rebellious, and she's going to find a way to get up to Idaho and do this thing so that she can talk to her mom again, or her stepdad, or her grandmother, or her sister. And Holcomb wants to stop her because what if it is the Bone Man who comes? He has power. He might find a way to come back that way. You can't go there. That is a very, very interesting prospect. Right now, I have no plans of writing that either. I want the Dead and Breakfast stories to be self-contained, but I haven't written one in a while. I started writing one in December and I didn't finish it. I didn't even get far into it. I didn't know. It was about a woman who comes to the bed and breakfast when Mason is first hired and he doesn't know that the place is haunted. But I never got anywhere with it because I didn't know who she was going to see that night. I could still finish it. If I keep writing every single day, I'll have to finish some of these stories. But like I said, I wanted them to be self-contained, but I can't rule it out. That's too good of an idea.
I guess those are just trying to tie in all of your other stories in there, those last couple questions. I really enjoyed the series. I'm looking forward to reading more. I've been meaning to sit down and write 10 questions about The Calling, the two stories that you've written in that, but I haven't done it yet. And now my memory's kind of fading, so I'm going to have to remind myself of some of the questions I had as I was reading those stories.
I wanted this just to be part of an episode, but I've been talking for almost an hour, and so this will have to be its own episode. I'm going to share with you a little bit of the one that I just finished this week, which is called Made Just For You. Just Made For You. Which is better? This is their first Christmas together. Laura took a sharp, excited breath. "Oh, I got an idea," Laura exclaimed, and ran over to Holcomb's side. "You and me should exchange magic Christmas gifts."
"You and I, Laura," Holcomb corrected.
"Who else? We could each cast a spell for each other. Something the other would like."
"A spell," Holcomb repeated.
The girl was smiling. And for a moment there, she looked as pretty as her beautiful sister had.
"Right. Like, for example, let's say you saw I was failing math, and so you cast..."
"Are you failing math, child?"
Holcomb interrupted.
No, I have at least a C.
That's not good enough, Holcomb commented.
Well, it's just an example. So don't really do this. But let's say I was failing, so you cast a spell, so suddenly I understand math perfectly. Wouldn't that be neat?
Very neat, child, Holcomb deadpanned. Of course, you could just open a book once in a while. That's a type of magic, I hear.
Lara ignored her. And let's say that you had a cold or something, so I cast a spell to make your cold go away.
And then you cure the cold by stopping my heart, Holcomb predicted.
No, no, it would be something I study and get right, and do for you for Christmas, and you do one for me.
She said it through a toothy grin that would probably necessitate braces to correct in the years to come. Or magic, Holcomb thought to herself. That could be done, in the same manner as fixing bones so they healed straight, or charming limps so they faded away. So healing my sickness, provided you could manage it, would be your gift to me.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, you could get me something else, like that sweater I liked, or a trip to the ice cream shop or something.
In December, child? Holcomb asked, dubious.
Sure. Ice cream still tastes good when it's cold outside. Or you could cast a spell so the ice cream is hot, but it doesn't melt.
I'm afraid that's beyond even my abilities, child.
Well, then you got to be more creative. Isn't that a fun idea?
She was so proud of this notion that it really was quite adorable.
And I'll get you a card or a snow globe or something, too, if you don't trust me to cast a good spell.
I don't, in fact.
So find me a snow globe with goblins or black cats or a woman sodomizing a village elder in it instead.
Yeah, right, Lara said, and laughed. She actually laughed at something Holcomb had said. A pre-Christmas miracle.
The witch took a moment to appreciate what had passed between them, and then decided to ruin it. Ignoring an ugly truth didn't make it any less ugly, her mother had said.
Of course, this sounds like the recipe for something going terribly wrong, which I have to sort out at the last minute.
Not this time, Lara promised. And then even she seemed to realize that her statement was ludicrously naive. Well, we can get the reset button set up anyway, just in case.
Holcomb didn't really get the reference, but she understood the sentiment. I think I can whip something up. Though if I were smart, I'd have a counterspell ready every time you tried to cast a spell.
Lara stuck her tongue out at her, then broke away and grabbed up her backpack from where she'd sat it on the table. Well, I'm going to go do my homework now, she said.
Is that a euphemism? Holcomb asked. You really are too young for that sort of thing.
My history homework, Lara clarified, sounding exasperated.
You said you'd finished your homework,
Holcomb said, aware that this was sounding very parental.
That was math. This is for U.S. history. Ah, let me save you the suspense. It was the white man's fault.
Yeah? The girl had heard this kind of nonsense before. According to the old woman's politics, even Lara was lumped in with the white man.
The Louisiana Purchase, that was the white man's fault.
The witch hadn't intended the statement to be anything other than a sardonic generalization, but if the shoe fit.
Why, yes, actually. Exactly that.
Oh, okay. I'll just put that in my report, see what kind of grade I get. Then the girl smiled again.
So, do we have a deal? I met your history teacher. He will not appreciate your attempt at...
No, not that, Lara interrupted. For Christmas. You and me exchange spells instead of presents.
Sure, yes. But try not to bite off more than you can chew.
I won't, promised the girl. But she hadn't even considered the statement.
This development might be more trouble than it was worth.
I see a couple of little bits that I'll probably have to fix on this. This was something that I wrote on the 23rd of December, the last day that the library was open before Christmas break. It's the most wholly comedic Lara and the Witch story. And I've really enjoyed exploring Holcomb's sense of humor. She's a sourpuss, but in a fun way. And her dealing with Lara's like problems and stuff like that makes me want to write a bunch of stories. I don't really know what it's like to be a teenage girl. I don't really know. Sorry. I write about them so much, but I don't know what it's like. And sometimes I will just write them as a boy, as me. Just, you know, a prettier version of me. And that may work. Or it might be exactly what Big Anklevich's wife complains about, where she says, "You can tell a man wrote this." Was that the same voice that I did for Holcomb? Ooh, that's scary. But you know what? I don't care what she says there. I write what I like. And I have to have enough faith in human beings to say that a teenage boy and a teenage girl could feel the same thing. That they could be more alike than they are different. That people are people. So why should it be that you and I should get along so awfully, huh?
All right, talk to you later, Rish. Bye-bye.
I want to thank Marshall Latham for...
Marshall of the New Republic.
...sending me these questions and for giving me another episode. And the irony, the delicious irony, is that he has to pay for this episode. Isn't that great? Of course, I have to pay for the Journey Into episodes that I do a voice on or I co-host with. So I guess there's some delicious irony there, too. Thank you, Marshall. Thank you, everybody that enjoys these stories, that wants me to do more, that wants to buy them. Encourage me to do more. I wrote 2 in a year, and that's never happened before. Of course, you know, once I did the Dead and Breakfast thing, I wrote multiples of those in a year. And part of it is just writing so much more than I used to. You know, I got to thank Abby Hilton. Without her, I wouldn't have a use for that lightning sound effect. And also, I never would have written the second story if it hadn't been for her. And so, there you go. And thank you. If you support me on Patreon, thank you. Wow, 5.3 times as much as if you don't. Wow. I forgot to carry the 1. 4.3. And if you don't support me on Patreon, consider doing it. You get episodes early. You get some episodes that only you get. And you get some interaction with me. I keep feeling like I need to put out more polls. And you get a Patreon address, which is basically a free episode every month where you just hang out with me. Yeah, on second thought, don't support me on Patreon. You don't want that. You have a great day. And, you know, be careful with the magic, okay? It's a double-edged sword.
This is fake Arnold Schwarzenegger. Normally, fake Sean Connery handles the licensed part of our show, but Rish told him he couldn't do it after saying that Rish Outfield should be released under a Creative Commons license because he is also free and no one could sell him and no one would take credit for him, not even his own mother. And saying,
fake Arnold, what are you doing?
He also changed the attribution to masturbation.
Dude, I told him he couldn't do it so he wouldn't say those cruel
and true
things about me.
Well, he didn't. Oh, and instead of share alike, he said share look alike.
Thank you, fake Arnold.
So the Rish Outcast is released under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 share alike license. You cannot sell it or claim it as your own, but you can download it and share look-alike it if you want to.
Okay, that's enough.
How did I do?
Pretty good, actually. This is a really bad story. I wonder why.
You're a bucket of crap. You're a bucket of crap. Do you enjoy being a bucket of crap? What is it like to be a bucket filled with crap?
where various napkins, bags, and receipts keep accumulating. And receipts keep accumulating. Ooh, that's a hard word to say. And receipts keep accumulating. But there are three other mother types surrounding her, and I dare not brave that. Dare not, really? Sorry. I'm very 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 sorry. Though, most of the time we called her Panda for short. She's a good girl. Loves her mama. Loves horses. And America, too. She's a good girl. Crazy about Elvis. Loves Jesus. And her boyfriend, too. Sorry. That's not even worth being an outtake, is it?